Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. Happy Easter. I am Terry Foy, once again joined by Nick Osello. Nick, it's the tailgate. It is the most immaculate of all tailgates. What a day to be alive. Thank you for joining me. Let's talk some lacrosse.
The tailgate on Easter. It's been a hectic weekend. And let me just dive into last night. So my sister, brother-in-law, other sister come into town. Turns out there was a high school friend and her husband that also came over. I'm in charge of cooking everything for dinner. We had a big roast for Christmas that we cut in half. And we put half of it in the freezer, pretty much for a specific event like this. We're hosting, like, I don't know, 11, 12 people. The miscommunication, Terry, and it all goes back to communication. Coach Corrigan would be so disappointed. I had to go get the rest of Dom's gifts. I was kind of like hosting and cooking. I was making homemade naan. I was making tzatziki. I was making chicken. And I was like, Dad, you got the roast. And he was like, yeah, we're just going to warm it up. I'm like, that's kind of a funny way to say, because that's kind of what cooking is. He thought that it was a pre-cooked roast that we froze that we just needed to literally warm up. So we had about 30 minutes until we were ready to eat, and we had a raw roast in the oven. And he pulls me aside, and he's just like, Nick, I can't believe what I'm about to tell you. I'm like, oh my God, what is it? I literally thought we had to warm up the roast. Like, we have a raw roast. So it was that perfect, like, oh my God, I'm an adult. This is the first time. You're also, throughout this episode, you're going to hear dogs barking. You're probably going to hear some background noise. Deal with it. Grow up. I'm the immaculate host. But just like the stress levels, everybody in town, I can't blow it. Oh my God. We ended up saving it. But that host stress.
I want to hear how you sliced it.
We made some au jus out of the drippings of the roast. We cut, like, I don't know, half an inch thick sections of the roast and just let it marinate. And then we kind of cranked it up so the au jus was boiling.
Did you eat at like 11 p.m. in that one episode of The Office where...
yeah, where they make ossobuco. Yeah. No, we ended up eating at 7:30. We just had... It was almost like a Greek hot pot. Where we just had au jus and we were like, okay, like this one's going to be done. Now we got to take it out, get the pita off. Like, oh my God, it was so great. I love Easter so much. And it was like the first, oh, now I'm an adult and I'm stressed about hosting Easter instead of going on the hunt.
Well, I'm really happy for you in terms of the stress level. Thank you for being an adult. I actually just want to get this one point off before we move into the games, which is that the turning of March into April always brings a little bit of sadness for me because I can kind of see the end in sight. And I know that that's fatalistic, getting ahead of yourself, everything that goes into that, like, you know, idea. And I should savor the moment. So I'm going to need you to bring the energy, lift me up. We had 86 Division I games on Saturday. It is the most Division I lacrosse games that have ever been played in the history of America, Canada, the world. So it is a reason to celebrate. But at the same time, I get this lingering sense of dread that we reached the mountaintop and now it's all downhill from here, which usually is a good expression because it means things are easier. But in this case, I'm like, I kind of like the uphill battle, buddy.
I like the uphill battle too, but it just means the stakes are a little bit higher. Things are getting more exciting.
And you gotta take the roast out of the freezer quick.
You gotta understand that we're cooking a roast, not just warming it up. And let's not forget, with the kind of, oh, it's gonna be the end of the season, the trees are blooming. There are cherry blossoms here in Idaho. You can go out and get some vitamin D. You can take the dipshit dogs for a walk and not have to put on six layers. I mean, there are so many different things. And so we just actually have a special guest because my girlfriend's dad, Nick Ferrara, has criticized me time and time again for my takes on this podcast. He's in the house. I gave him three points that he wants to make. Nick Ferrara, what do we have? I just unplugged the mic, so we're hopefully going to hear it come through clearly. Well, what do we got, Nick?
Three predictions?
Three predictions.
Well, three predictions are very simple. I mean, it's going to be very much like it was last year, okay? You're not going to see a lot of new stuff. You're going to probably see the same Final Four that you saw last year. You're going to see Notre Dame, you're going to see Virginia, you're going to see Duke, and you're going to see Penn State. But the dark horse, and this is what I gave Nick last year, was the dark horse for me was Penn State. They got into the Final Four. This year, my dark horse is Army. I think Army right now is a team to watch. You know, a lot of people are losing confidence in Army after one loss. I mean, it's crazy, right? They have one loss, and you know, because they're not with the old school teams and so on and so forth, you forget about them. They're a dark horse. I think they're going to challenge in the playoffs and so on. But, you know, right now it's going to be, you know, you're probably going to see the same old suspects. You're going to see Notre Dame. You're going to see Duke, Virginia, and I'm saying probably Penn State. I really like Penn State a lot. I think they're a good, strong team and so on. But the surprise of this year is Colgate. Colgate's a team that seems like they're really coming up. They have a solid team. Tough game against Navy yesterday. I'm sure you heard about it. They lost by a goal. They have a really good roster, young team, only six seniors. You know, that's a team I watch for in the future.
All right. Hey, we're going to keep track of those. And now that your opinion's out there, it's maybe a little more tougher to criticize mine, maybe.
Well, I'm not criticizing you, but, you know, I do give you the rankings and stuff ahead of time.
So, and you're Irish,
hopefully
right?
Hopefully you listen to me. 100% not.
You're Irish?
No.
Oh,
you know I'm not. All right. But Terry, it's great talking to you. You take care of yourself.
Likewise. Thank you, Nick.
All right, my friend. Take care.
This podcast needed two Nicks. That is, it just didn't have enough Nicks on it. That's what it came down to.
You see what I have to deal with? You see what I have to deal with? So, he'll listen to this, take notes on a notepad, and then be like, Nick, I wanted to talk to you about some of the points you made on the podcast that I disagree with. And I'm like, you have your chance. So those three predictions, Final Four and Colgate. Army is a sleeper when they're the number one, bold. But that was just a little treat for the fans at home. Terry, you want to dive into the games? I feel like...
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, so what was kind of funny about this is that for as crazy as the weekend was, in terms of the breadth and how high stakes some of the games were and everything else, it did feel like relative to some of the weeks prior, we kind of lacked that central storyline that kind of came away from it. And I think ultimately it was because at like 12:55, 1:15 Eastern time on Saturday... It was as if the entire snow globe was going to get shaken and the world of college lacrosse was going to be turned on its head. Now, that did not happen. I think when it comes to why, how, what we need to figure out and parse out, it does start in South Bend, as much as it pains me to say. And Nick, I know that you're very familiar with what happened with respect to the Fighting Irish hosting the Syracuse Orange, a team that they have had their number over the course of the last five, six, seven meetings.
It's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, infinity. Notre Dame owns Syracuse. And my former other podcast co-host, Evan, said that Syracuse was going to win by 7. What a stupid idiot. You couldn't be dumb. You couldn't be dumber than thinking that Syracuse was going to win. But what's interesting about this is you hit the nail on the head, because as I was kind of writing out a lot of these, there wasn't the... Oh, no lead is safe. There wasn't this position kind of, you know, really dominated. So it's almost nice to break down these games individually. So if you didn't watch, Notre Dame ended up winning 14-12. They got out to a lead. And there were certain times watching that game where you kind of were like, oh, here we see this script of the team who's in front is going to get caught up and it's going to be a fireworks finish. That's what impressed me most about the Notre Dame performance. Wasn't that they were able to jump out to the lead, but that they answered the blows that Syracuse had that we've seen constantly over the course of the season, regardless of what team has been playing. So what's interesting to me is Notre Dame's ability to answer those blows and their dominance at the faceoff X. Will Lynch ended up going 19 for 26, and that was the massive impact of the game. And we'll get to the SportsCenter number one play in a second, obviously. 10 different goal scorers for Notre Dame. Finn Thompson, Michael Leo, and Luke Roa scored 7 of Cuse's goals, which is about half. But they also had kind of a nice, balanced offense. So you can go back to Will Lynch. And Terry, let me just say this. The fact that the midseason All-Americans came out, and I don't know, some goalie from Syracuse was the first team All-American and Liam Eneman was the second team All-American. Talk about the dumbest thing you could possibly do. I think Liam Eneman maybe took a little bit of note on that and made
undoubtedly the save of the season so far, potentially the save of the last two, three seasons. The only one that I can really think of would be Bernlohr's save on Cloutier in the national championship, however many years ago that is. I almost just ran out of breath. I'm so fired up about it. And that was on a man down for Notre Dame. Great ball movement for Syracuse. Syracuse's man up, second only to Harvard as terms of fun to watch, I would say. But that back cross crease pass diving save, Liam Eneman is the best goalie in the country. He's better than half the goalies on the PLL right now. Yeah. So Notre Dame remains number one. And I will say, I was curious as to, is the number one spot being cursed going to take precedent over Notre Dame eating Syracuse's lunch every single year? Notre Dame has Syracuse's number more than the number one spot is cursed this year. Terry, what did you see?
Yeah, so first of all, it's kind of funny, man. I'm going to try not to be like too self-reflective in this analysis, but it's just so hard because like when we talk about Lynch, I just go back to the performance after Georgetown and Maryland, the first time we were recording this podcast when he was a freshman, and I kept saying he's going to get better. And now it feels like he's getting better. And you see Greg Grenlein tweeting about how his reversals and his like contrary exits are just so much more sophisticated than they previously were. And of course, like that was in response to a comment about how it felt like his confidence and success was building on top of an incredible performance in the NCAA tournament, in the way in which that kind of echoed what Luke Weirman had from 21 to 22. And so I'm not trying to say like you couldn't see this coming or we did see this coming, but you did see this coming. And so the fact is that what's interesting is Mason Cone and then subsequently Johnny Mullen had been so successful when they had run into difficult faceoff matchups. And I think that when you look at the faceoff matchup in this game, what I take away is what does it mean for Syracuse going forward, right? When they take on Carolina or Duke or whomever, well, they obviously already played Duke, but when they take on Carolina or Virginia and flesh out the rest of, or Cornell, who they're going to play on Tuesday, flesh out the rest of their ACC schedule, what does it mean for them? You know, with respect to Notre Dame, they're the best offense in the country. And so it doesn't take a lot in terms of possession advantage in order for that to put them over the top. Now, when you pair the best faceoff, or I'm sorry, the best offense in the country with a good faceoff group and then a goalie who can steal goals from you, right? And especially if you're a defense that's going to give up 12 or 13 goals a game, you know, every individual goal might be the one that ends up winning the game for you. And theoretically, that's exactly what we saw when he dove cross crease and hit the, you know, kind of midpoint of his stick on a shot that should have gone in 92 times out of 100, whatever the case may be. It was an incredible play. It deserved to be SportsCenter number one. But what was interesting for me about this was the night before, I was meeting up with a friend who was in town to watch the Michigan-Hopkins game, and he was telling me about an instance that happened in the Michigan-Notre Dame game. And he was like, Liam Entenmann baited a Michigan shooter to go low so that he could click his heels together like a leprechaun and save the ball with his heels, which is exactly what happened. Like, usually when you hear about goalies baiting shooters, it is they crouch down and then explode up. Like, no, he stayed high and kind of jumped in order to convince a shooter to go low and then saved it with his heels. So I'm at the point where there really isn't anything that Liam Entenmann can't do when it comes to the sport of lacrosse. And not only is he potentially better than half the goalies in the PLL, I thought that when Quinn Kestick was talking about Paul Carcaterra's big board during this game and just said he's a plug-in, ready-made goalie in the PLL, that's exactly the way that I feel. I mean, again, like you and I talked earlier this year about Logan McNaney and Liam Entenmann being the Team USA goalies for the next 3-4 tournaments. And there's nothing that I've seen this year that deters me from that point of view. And so you can parse this game a number of different ways. I think that it would be irresponsible not to talk about the performance that Sean Light put in against Joey Spallina. But again, you know, you get to the point where it's just like, yeah, he's been guarded by some really good players and he's been limited to 3 points. Well, Pat Cavanaugh and Chris Cavanaugh were both limited to 3 points by Syracuse's defense, which also had come off in a performance where they had limited Duke to 4 goals total. So I guess my point is that, you know, Sean Light looked really good. Joey Spallini got limited to 3 points rather. Maybe that's just what happens when you play a really good team. So there are a lot of ways to spin this, a lot of ways to unwind it. I kind of settle into the fact that Syracuse has lost three games now, 2 overtime games at home, and 1 2-goal game on the road where they showed impressive resilience down the stretch. Can they make it to the Final Four? I don't know. They're right there on the borderline, right? I think they are very clearly a quarterfinalist, and whether or not they advance to the Final Four is going to come down to their performance in the last 5 minutes of that game. Notre Dame, a bona fide repeat national champion, and they showed it in every way on Saturday afternoon in South Bend.
Yeah, and honestly, credit to the 2015 Notre Dame team kind of paved the way for the real analysis and doing my best to put my bias aside. I will preface this for this upcoming statement, doing my best. I remember we were talking about that 2021 Maryland team and how it was so difficult to game plan against them because they had a good defense, a good offense, good transition, good goalie, good faceoff. And I likened it to what I knew at the time, which was trying to game plan against the Whip Snakes, because going into that, you kind of knew that you would have had to play a perfect game, which makes the Georgetown loss a little more, you know, curious. And, you know, I've kind of put that in the rearview mirror. But as we watch the maturation of this Notre Dame program, as it relates to this season, Will Lynch stepping out, Liam Enemann solidifying himself as the upper echelon, as he's done time and time again. Even the defensive cues of, okay, we're making adjustments to what Syracuse is doing on offense, knowing that we have a goalie behind us, transition players, good short stick D-middies, and an offense that can cut any wound and suture that up with one possession, with one flick of the stick, with one pass to Jake Taylor. We saw in the national championship last year, even when the offense is all but shut down, in the quarterfinal or semifinals against Virginia, they have players like Eric Dobson that can quite simply take over the game with their size and athleticism. So as I go down this line of boxes that Notre Dame checks, I don't think there's a comparable program this year. And it brings me back to that 21 Maryland squad where it was like, find the hole. Game planning against this team is a nightmare. You have to play perfect. So to Syracuse's credit, and I'm just going to go directly against what you said and not try to be too self-reflective, this is exactly the Syracuse team that I think is a nightmare next year. We talked about 2 years ago how they were young, they were losing, but they had the talent. Last year, we were talking about how they've taken steps forward, but they're not quite over the hump. And right now, I think they're a team that's figuring out how to take two aspects of the game, not letting teams jump out to leads and learning how to have the slugfest back and forth, learning how to throw punches that are just a little bit harder, making a little bit easier of a pass, not having to rely on, a ridiculous individual effort. And, you know, I just don't think Syracuse is there this year, but boy, I just feel like that program's trajectory is going to put them in a place where next year they could be the shoe-in Final Four. How do we game plan against Syracuse? Overall, a great display of lacrosse. Awesome crowd at Arlotta. What a day of lacrosse. I mean, Easter Sunday, you thought Notre Dame was going to lose on Easter weekend. How stupid could you be?
No football players taking off their shirts on the far sideline, though.
And what a bummer that was. So I'm gonna get Coach Freeman on the phone and say, we need your hottest football players with their shirts off on the sidelines.
Nope, not hottest, ugliest. Definitely need your ugliest, fattest football players on the sideline taking their shirts off.
You know what? I think that's beautiful, personally. And I think correct. That was a gross comment, Terry.
What? No, I'm fat and ugly positive. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, that's why he chose me as a co-host.
Correct.
Moving on. And for those of you that say I'm a Notre Dame homer, I tell you when I'm a Notre Dame homer, and I tell you when I'm giving you good analysis. And that's the Osello difference. Notre Dame's going to win it this year. So Hopkins, Michigan, the Big Ten takes a little bit of clarity and some shape. Hopkins is now 2-0 in the Big Ten. And we talked about at the top of the show about how the kind of storylines are going to directly contradict each other. Notre Dame's face-off performance led them to a victory. Well, Hopkins proves that wrong in this game. They lost 14 of 17 in the first half, which for them to be in it and to end up getting a four goal relatively decisive game, overcoming that first half faceoff deficit, I don't think you understand, and what a cocky, stupid thing to say, but it's very difficult to understand the toll that it takes on the defense, the wing units, the long poles, the goalies, you know, the faceoff guy, obviously. But it has the ability to wear down your entire defense to where, why are they playing make it, take it? Well, because the defense is tired, and that always plays in favor of the offense. But what Hopkins did a really good job of was causing turnovers. So they caused, what was it, eight turnovers throughout the
game?
Eight
in the first half, yeah.
Eight in the first half, which kind of counterbalanced
that.
Yeah. And so it was kind of this really interesting, okay, so how did they overcome this faceoff deficit? By doing a great job of causing turnovers and having those be impactful turnovers, not just getting possession and having it checked out of their stick in the first 5 seconds. And the storyline to me was not only their ability to overcome that through other areas of the game, but was Russell Melendez. I don't want to call it a breakout game, you know, a breakout game in quotes is what I'll say, because maybe we expected this. Maybe we expected this from, you know, sooner in the season. Is he establishing himself from the narrative that, that you and I have talked about, kind of about how, you know, hey, really, what is Hopkins offense trying to do? They're sharing the love. They had some struggles early on in the season. But Russell Melendez kind of took over, and the narrative that we've placed on Hopkins. And I have two questions for you. Were we wrong about that narrative? And is Russell Melendez going to be kind of the pivotal point of Hopkins' offense moving forward? And then the second is, how good is Michigan? Because they beat Maryland last week. And then to call a spade, they lost pretty badly to Hopkins. I don't think even with that faceoff, there was with that faceoff advantage in the first half, there wasn't really a point where I was like, oh, you know, Hopkins is in trouble if they don't do insert whatever I was seeing.
Yeah. So the Melendez question is a really interesting one. And one of the elements that makes it interesting is how you value what you get out of your offense players. And so to go back to that conversation that I was having on Friday night, where we talked about the incredible Liam Menteman save on a Michigan offensive player, one of the other elements or one of the other conversations that was had was about how Justin Tiernan, who's leading college lacrosse, leading Division I in goals scored, was not a midseason All-American. And the comment in response is, it depends on what you value. And so the media definitely emulates what the coaches value, right? And not only that, but also like the inside lacrosse media All-Americans and certainly the midseason All-Americans. It's like a 10-year creation, right? Whereas the USILA All-Americans are 110 years, right? So we're always going to take our cues from what they have demonstrated. And for me personally, when it comes to what are the kind of signature decisions that were made relative to this player is better than this player. This player is a first team All-American. This player is a third team or an honorable mention or doesn't even get acknowledged at all, right? So it's like Matanowski over Zach Greer. It's Ned Crotty over Max Quinzani. It is Steele Stanwyck over Chris Bocklet. And the point is that coaches have shown time and again that they value dual threat, meaning the ability to dodge to shoot and dodge to feed attackmen over goal scorers. One of the elements of this, and this is where I kind of deviate, I think, a little bit from the norm or a little bit from the consensus opinion, is Russell Melendez, what he poses is the ability to beat a guy, go to the goal and score, right? He scored 37 goals last year. He was not, like, we put him on the cover of this preseason issue of Inside Lacrosse magazine, despite the fact that he was not his team's leading scorer. The reason being that the interpretation of what he brought to the offense was not only more valuable, but also more scarce or less replicatable by somebody else in terms of his ability to get his own. I always call it like the end of the shot clock goal. And obviously, it comes down to the role that he fills in terms of like the overall offense, like what he brings more broadly or more generally. But the simple fact is that he just wasn't very productive through the first 9 games of this season. And I didn't realize this until I started to write the game story for yesterday's game, he wasn't very productive in the first nine games of last season relative to how productive he was in the last nine games. And so I think the question becomes, is that what's happening now? And I also think it's interesting because the question actually kind of opens up its aperture. There are some players who just don't play well early in the season, and then they play well later in the season. And you can make a really interesting case or ask the really interesting question, is that what we're seeing out of Michigan faceoff specialist Justin Wiefeldt right now as well? When you look at how his season unfolded last year versus this year, and when you look at how the first half of this season unfolded as well. And so to dial down or to drill in a little bit deeper on this game in particular, first of all, I want to say, Nick, I got in the booth. I called a game on Friday night.
And how was it, Terry? That was going to be my follow-up question. You beat me to it.
It was so much fun, which I think is the most important thing. And the reason I bring it up in this context is because the way in which Lehigh at Loyola unfolded, at least as far as the first half is concerned, compared to how Michigan at Johns Hopkins unfolded, is incredibly similar. One team dominated faceoffs. They committed a ton of turnovers. They jumped out to a 4-2 lead, and the other team then responded, and Loyola led 8-5, Hopkins led 9-6, roughly equivalent. And then, you know, the second half of the game unfolded similarly equivalently insofar as, you know, one team essentially tried to hold on. Loyola was a little bit more threatened than Hopkins was down the stretch. But it was just so wild to cover the game on Friday night and then be covering the game on Saturday and just be like confronted with the fact that this game is unfolding so similarly to the game that I just did last night. And when it comes to, you know, Michigan is very injured all over the roster, but in terms of the players on the field offensively, they have guys that are very hampered. And now, that's not to make excuses because that's true for everybody, and I don't know all of the team's injuries. You know, just got a little bit of an update as far as, you know, Michigan's offensive personnel. But the point is that when it comes to the way in which games like that unfold, so you get out to a lead, you fall behind, it just becomes a tipping point function, right? Like, you just have to get it to one. You have to get it tied, right? Like, you just have to figure out a way. And they weren't able to do that, which is a credit to Hopkins in terms of what they were able to do from a defensive personnel standpoint, what they were able to do from a faceoff standpoint. And candidly, it's another element of this game that actually unfolded very similarly. Hopkins responded in the third quarter at the faceoff X in a way that didn't necessarily sustain itself in the fourth quarter, but was enough to stem the tide, cut off the momentum that they had built, and shift the momentum, shift the dynamic of the game in a way that ultimately they were able to sustain and then carry that over the finish. And so the crazy part about it is that your comment that it never really felt like Hopkins was in danger, I don't disagree with that. But at the same time, it also didn't feel like a game where the teams were four goals apart, right? Like, I don't come away from that feeling like Hopkins is four goals better than Michigan. That being said, the divergence in terms of stakes and what it means going forward, well, now we have Hopkins is 2-0. I'm pretty sure they're the only 2-0 team in the Big Ten. They've got Penn State coming to town, who's 1-1 after a loss to Maryland at home tonight. And now they get an opportunity to separate even farther, and there will definitely be a 2-1 team in the rearview mirror. But it's not going to, if they win, it's not going to be the Nittany Lions. And they were the team that was the highest ranked team in the Big Ten for the first half of the season. So stakes are super high. Outcomes are very clear. Margins are very narrow. It is literally like the definition of late March lacrosse. And to the extent that I feel sad, I also feel incredibly emboldened and incredibly invigorated by that reality.
And when I started writing this, Penn State was up 10-7. So the fact that Maryland ended up winning 13-11, great job by Maryland to come back. I can't wait to watch that film. And there are a couple points that I want to touch on because I think you nailed it on the head, was Hopkins' adjustment didn't necessarily prevent Michigan from staging a comeback. It just did enough to throw off Michigan's blueprint to execute a comeback. And sometimes that's all you need. I remember when, you know, I was playing and we had a lead and they started to get momentum. We would make not an adjustment, but a minor alteration to our existing game plan. Let's just slide a little bit earlier. Let's not slide at all and make them shoot it from outside, still playing within our systems. And I think that's what Hopkins did, you know, did a good job of. And I think that's a lot of times where teams don't get enough credit, because they, you know, if you're watching that game, you're kind of looking at it from a Michigan lens perspective, because the pressure is on them to mount the comeback. And while Hopkins kind of did that, they did it long and well enough to, you know, come away with that 4-goal win. So if you're ever watching a comeback mounted, just know that the team that prevents it, it's not this big game-changing chessboard match. Sometimes it's just throwing out one minor detail that will end up shifting the tide of the game insofar as it just prevents that momentum from being consistently built. And that's, I love that little chess game of let's tweak something, not to shut them down. We're not going to stop them from preventing goals, but let's stop them from getting those easy goals. And I love watching lacrosse. It's a very fun sport. Anything else on Hopkins, Michigan before we move on?
Let's keep it rolling. But that being said, I also do want to quickly kind of deviate from the outline or rundown that we had shared, because I think this is the right time to talk about Maryland Penn State. We're not in a position to talk in depth about it. We were recording when Maryland made their comeback, and you know, I had it on, but I wasn't paying close attention. I want to make a couple points. So Nick, we don't talk about gambling a ton on this podcast, but we talk about it enough that you can appreciate this. So I have a friend. All right. Well, first of all, so I got out to whatever kind of like fast start I got out to. Let's just say I was like 12 and 8 probably through
that's
the first.
That's a fast
3 weeks.
Start for you. 12 that's
and
fine. 4.
Yeah. Well, whatever. Yeah. 60%. It's a D in most grading districts. In the first 4 weeks of our staff picks, and then I hit the skids. Yeah, I think I went 1-4 1 week and then 0-5 the next week. And everybody jumped off the bandwagon. I had a friend, Josh Davey, used to work at Inside Lacrosse. He didn't jump off the bandwagon. He doubled down. And you know how I repaid him? So he parlayed my picks 2 weeks ago. I started 4-0. And then I went to the Princeton-Cornell game. And if you remember, we talked about this game.
Oh, what a game.
Princeton came out of the timeout, tied game, with an opportunity to win. Committed a turnover. Cornell came down and scored. If you know anything about gambling, that means that his 5-game parlay lost, despite the fact
the
that it started 4-0.
On the worst beat of the season. Oh, my God.
So what does my friend do? He jumps right back on the bandwagon and does it all over again. And what do? I start 4-0. And what do? I lose the last game.
Oh, no.
So now it's week 3. Right? And keep in mind, when he played my picks 3 weeks ago, I was like, bro, you know how cold I am, right? He's like, yeah, I'm riding with you anyway. I'm like, all right, I appreciate the support. So he rides with me again today, this weekend. What did I do? Started 4-0. Took Penn State against Maryland.
Oh, no.
It's not even that. Oh. They got out to an 8-4 lead. I mean, this was like, I think it was 6-2. It was 6-2 at the end of the first quarter. It was 8-4 in the second quarter. Like, this was money in the bank. This is, honey, buy that fur coat that you've had on layaway at Burlington Coat Factory for the last 3 weeks type situation. So, unbelievable job by John Tillman to respond. I didn't know this. Penn State has never beaten Maryland in State College. They were 0-4. I mean, just heartbreak like you read about. I don't expect you to have anything insightful to say, but please say whatever, because it's probably going to be pretty funny.
Oh, I mean, heartbreak, and what a timely analogy to make. That's biblical heartbreak right there. That is Old Testament heartbreak. And it just sounds like if you hop aboard the Terry Choo Choo train, the gambling train, Terry's train will get you 95% of the way and then ram right into the station and blow up everything. So, you know,
how dumb are five game parlays that I can go 12-3 over my last 15 picks and you will win $0. It just is mind defying.
And not just the three games. It wasn't like you were losing the first game. That Princeton game is probably the worst beat of the season.
Correct.
That Penn State game has to be up there as well. Oh my God. God bless your friend. And I hope that, you know what? I might try to ride that train or at least get a couple of my buddies to hop on there, because if one of us goes down, we all go down. But if one of us makes it, book those tickets to Cabo, baby.
The middle pick was I picked Rutgers over Hopkins last week, and that was a total – the entire – like last week was all about just going against yourself, right? Like it was the Costanza, if everything you think is wrong – or I'm sorry, yeah, everything you think is right is wrong, then everything you think is right must be wrong. Whatever. Figure it out for yourself.
Yeah.
Like that was – and it worked. Like everything that I did on Saturday worked. It just turns out that apparently Costanza doesn't deliver on Sunday.
It turns out you were right. Oh, correct. And what a terrible time to be right. What was the name of your buddy again?
Josh Davey.
Josh, you know, call me. We can talk about our bad beats together. I'm a shoulder to cry on. I'm an open ear. And I hope you get on Terry's Wild Ride again this upcoming weekend.
Josh actually provided me with this very, very sleek New Balance short sleeve hoodie, which is actually going to be showing up at the Osello household in the not too distant future. So That shoulder that's going to be cried on is going to have some sort of like polyurethane mix.
That would actually be great branding. Hey, we're going to sell it to Brown fans. It's tear wicking material. And, you know, you don't even have to wash it after your heartbreaking losses. We should send 15 to Larkin Camp. Okay, so moving on and getting this train back on the wagon before, you know, it derails at the very end. This was a great game. UVA-Harvard. So UVA ended up winning 13-10. But my goodness, I am still so impressed with Harvard's losses. Yes, there's a goalie goal. I'll talk about that in a second because my goodness. But so Harvard's lost three close games to Yale, Princeton, and now UVA, and they were up for most of the game. They were up 5. They were up 10-6 early in the fourth quarter. They had a 4-goal lead in the fourth quarter, and UVA needed a massive comeback. So they claw their way back to 10-10. And Terry, normally goalie goals are garbage, junk time. We're up 15-3, and I'm just feeling myself, and I'm going to get cocky and go for it. Nunez, are you kidding me that it's 10-10 in a comeback, and he sprints down, beats the middle of it, you know, right through the middle. You know, if I was Carcaterra, I'd say right down, you know, Harvard Lane or whatever street is over
Mass
there.
Ave.
Mass
Ave. Ave. Commonwealth Ave. Commonwealth yeah. Avenue. That's what it's called.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Quicker Avenue. Know.
They go right down Pilgrim Hedge Lane. Fund Avenue, and he buries it bottom left. And when that was the goal that gave Virginia their first lead of the entire game, you're not coming back from that. Like, there's just no way that you're coming back from that. And it's the biggest goal since Reardon scored against Cornell. I think it was in the quarterfinals in 2015.
It was.
And so this goes back to our other contradictory point about how no lead is safe. So this is the storyline that we've touched on earlier. And I got to say, again, like, call me biased because I played under Coach Byrne, but Harvard's performance for, you know, 3.5 quarters was almost perfect. Good, you know, everybody contributing, great ball movement. Their offense was on fire. Their defense was playing great. Their goalie was making saves. But there's something about Virginia, and we framed it as whenever we would be getting ready to play them, they just have stallions that can run. They have the stallions. We've talked about it ad nauseum over the course of this podcast. So when they don't quit, and when UVA is looking to claw their way out of the out of a deficit to achieve a victory, their roster is filled with freak athletes who can make anything happen at any point. And when they get hot, their momentum is unstoppable and undeniable. And they were talking in the post-game press conferences I was reading about, they were talking about how resilience is baked into their DNA. Oh, yeah, you get all the recruits all the time and you have a historical program. Must be resilience. But credit to them for actually proving that this week. And also shout out to Harvard's atmosphere. It was alumni weekend, full stands, the biggest capacity for a Harvard game, I think, in program history, if I'm not mistaken. And overall, this was just, the best game of the weekend, which I'm also going to retract as we go into the next game. But Terry, UVA survives a close scare against Harvard.
So this was my second screen game. I was watching Hopkins, Michigan most closely because that was the one I was writing the article about. But this was the one that I had like on my iPad while I was watching that one. And it's crazy because for when you watch a game and you aren't focusing on it solely, and then you look at the box score or the numbers, and you can be shocked by how stark they are. So listen to this. In the third quarter, Harvard outshot Virginia 20-6. In the fourth quarter, Virginia outshot Harvard 18-5. Harvard has struggled facing off in their big games in recent weeks. In this game, they won 4 out of 6 in the second quarter, and 5 out of 7 in the third quarter. And then, and it's really important to note that for me, dating all the way back to the preseason, when you were thinking about Virginia and what their potential weaknesses might be, the faceoff X was the primary thing. And it's very clear that the staff felt that way because they brought in 3 transfers. And when you look at how their season has unfolded, the game they lost to Hopkins was the one that Anthony Gabriel didn't play. And so as a result, it's also easy to say like, all right, well, very clearly that is a huge factor in what determines how successful you are. Virginia won 8 of 9 faceoffs in the fourth quarter. And when I was watching the fourth quarter and I saw the Cavaliers, I mean, they took the lead pretty early in the fourth quarter and then just kind of separated, and it never really felt like Harvard was able to threatened late. Kind of felt like Harvard lost the game in that last 5-minute stretch of the third. But it was just one of those games where it kind of felt like that tidal wave dynamic of the pressure that Virginia imposes on you offensively. And then it can be, it can be complemented by the faceoff. It can be complemented defensively. But really what it comes down to is the pressure they impose offensively. It felt like that was happening. But what's crazy, again, you look at it, Connor Schellenberger, 0 goals, 2 assists. McCabe Millen, 0 goals, 3 assists. The fact that those guys didn't actually put the ball in the back of the net suggests that Harvard was able to do roughly what they wanted to do defensively in terms of getting the ball out of their sticks. I'm assuming, I don't know this to be true, but it wouldn't seem shocking if their priorities defensively were to not let Connor Schellenberger beat them as a scorer, not let McCabe Millen beat them as a scorer. And then it ended up manifesting in those guys turning into assisters. And then whether it was Griffin Schatz or Peyton Cormier or any of a handful of other guys who contributed 1 or 2 goals, that ended up being the difference in the game. But disappointing because the simple fact is it feels like offensively Harvard was in a position to win the game and they didn't get the ball enough in the fourth quarter in order to be able to try to close it out.
A lot of what I kind of view these, late March, early April games as is, what are you putting on film? And I think what Harvard did a great job of in the first half was kind of putting that, what is the ideal game plan to prevent Virginia from getting hot. And the interesting and potentially frustrating part for other teams is it's going to be very hard to emulate. That burn method defense that we talk about seemingly on a week-to-week basis, it can be executed at a very high level. And as we've seen over the course of the year, it can be executed at a very low level. So I thought what they did a really good job of was not giving Virginia any consistent looks. Virginia has a couple things that they like to do consistently through Schellenberger, through all these different guys that we talk about. So throwing out an early slide, making sure that this particular skip pass that they don't like is unavailable, making sure that taking away that skip pass doesn't lead the throwback to the step down. An incredible defensive performance by Harvard for one half. But what's even scary is on the flip side, Virginia's ability to overcome that and make sure that, hey, one bad half of lacrosse, three bad, you know, 2.5 to 3 bad quarters of lacrosse, it quite frankly doesn't matter. They're playing like a team that's like, hey, we're the best team. We know it. And we decide when we can turn it on. And of all the teams that kind of have that storyline that we've been saying all season about how no lead is insurmountable, it seems like that truly is the case for Virginia, because they can do it in a number of ways with anybody in their stick. Even looking at Notre Dame's offense, I would say if they're digging themselves out of a hole, Virginia learned last year, hey, maybe we should just send 15 guys on the field to Dobson. You know, who else is going to be trying to full sail? You have Pat Cavanaugh, you have Jake Taylor. I would rather have a deficit as a coach with Virginia's offensive personnel than Notre Dame's. And I don't think that's a crazy thing to say at all.
So I think the way that this season has unfolded so far is the preseason started. It was Duke, Notre Dame, Virginia tier. And then how close is the next tier? Who's in the next tier? And if you remember, like, my comment at the time was, I think Maryland's fourth and they might be in that top tier or they might be in the second tier. We'll see how the season unfolds. And depending on how you viewed that Penn State game tonight, maybe they actually are in that tier. We'll find out. But the point is that Duke has shown that they have more serious flaws. It appears that Notre Dame and Virginia are the teams to beat. I think, and you know, Quint talked about this a lot on the broadcast against Syracuse. He talked about it a little bit on prior broadcasts as well. I do think that there are flaws in Notre Dame's, and it's hard to isolate whether or not it's schematic or whether it's personnel, but defensively, there are flaws. They give up more goals than they want to. They rely on Liam Entman to cover up more than they want to. That is, like, their flaw. Virginia's flaw coming into the season was going to be at the faceoff X. I just said it, like, 4 minutes ago. It is not as substantial of a flaw as it appeared it was going to be. Their defensive personnel, specifically Cole Kastner, is top-notch. Matt Nunes scores goals. That makes up for letting in goals. Not at the Liam Entman level. Still very good. I think he was I don't think he was the most outstanding player of the NCAA tournament, but he's a really good player. So I don't think he's going to lose some games. My point is, I think Virginia has the fewest flaws right now. Now, will I feel that way in 6 weeks? I don't know. Is it that the team with the fewest flaws wins the national championship? Probably not. I think that it actually is more about your ceiling than it is about your floor. And I think your flaws define your floor as opposed to defining your ceiling. But I do think that I want to get it on record right now that I think Virginia has the fewest flaws of any roster or any team in Division I right now. And I don't know how that's going to manifest, but I think that, relatively speaking, they're the most undervalued team, which is to say that they're the number two team. And I don't know. I wouldn't even take them to beat Notre Dame because of the way in which that series dynamic works out. I just think that, like, if it's like you have to, if the championship were decided by, like, we're going to create this avatar of a really good team and whoever beats it the most times out of 10 wins, in that scenario, I could see Virginia winning.
Well, and, you know, let's not forget that now opposing defenses have to game plan for a goalie. What a great job.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. Yeah. You don't want to have to do that.
that was a great point where it's like, yeah, he lets in goals, but he scores them as well. I hope everybody picked up on that because that was a hell of a line there. I mean, Moving on.
Hold on. Before we move on, are you aware that when I was in high school, we once lost. I was a goalie. I was not the goalie that was in the game at this time because I was not the starter on the team at this time. We once lost an overtime game when the opposing goalie scored on a high-to-high shot from, like, the restraining line.
Oh, a Pacino shot?
A Pacino shot, correct.
Well, I hope your goalie quit immediately, and I hope you got the starting job the next game.
He's good people.
Not that good.
Yeah, I mean, he's good at life. He just wasn't Wasn't good at stopping high shots from 46 that day.
Yeah, who cares? You couldn't stop a shot. You couldn't stop the ball. We actually had a goalie goal, and one of the attackmen was offsides, and we were so mean to that attackman, he quit the next season. So, little fun fact about the Wheat Ridge lacrosse dynamics. And then our friendship soured, and it was actually a very sad story. But moving on to Penn Cornell. What a great game this was. So, I called UVA Harvard the game of the weekend. Psych. Now we're just manufacturing the going against the narratives. Penn takes down Cornell 11-10 in not just one overtime, Terry, but two overtimes, a little second serving of dessert in preparation for that Easter brunch. Penn is quite simply, I made the joke about like my strange addiction. Penn is addicted to close games. They couldn't have proved me more right. Cornell rushed out to a 6-2 lead. And again, in this whole conflicting storyline, you can't paint with a wide brush. This goes back to the game we just talked about where UVA overcame the lead. Syracuse couldn't, Michigan couldn't. Well, it turns out UVA and Penn can. Penn's Cam Rubin and little-known player CJ Kirst were kind of going back and forth in this goal scoring, with Rubin ending up with 6, Kirst ending up with 4. Ultimately, it was Rubin's 6th that was the nail in the coffin in second overtime when a great pass back from the top midfielder turned into a hitch, which turned into a goal and ball game. And what's interesting to me about this, we can dive into the details of the game, but Penn improves to 7-3, and they're undefeated in the Ivy. Yale falls to 5-3. April, we're starting off and we're staring in the end of the face, like we're staring the end of the season kind of in the face, and you can cry and load up your diaper about it, you know, woe is me, I'm Terry Foy. But the Ivy League's starting to become unbelievably interesting because I don't know who's going to beat who. So, Terry, this game I think represents a little bit of that Ivy League mishmash. Cornell's 5-3. They have losses to Denver, Penn State, and now Penn. You know, what a great litmus test for what the Ivy League is going to be doing, because I would have bet the farm. If your buddy was riding with me, I would have said, forget a parlay, put $100,000 on Cornell, and then I would have had to flee the country.
Where would you have gone? Zawan Taneho?
What a great reference. If you don't get that reference, turn off the podcast and don't ever listen again until next weekend. I probably would have just gone to Montana.
Yeah, I would have said, flee the country.
I would have said, I'm fleeing the country, and he would have gone all over the country, and I'm in Butte, Montana, baby. Come and get me. But
so, I don't know, man. Like, I just have, I can't have a strong reaction to this because of the same thing that we have said over and over and over again. Penn only plays close games. Of course, if you play close games, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. Doesn't matter. I asked Mike Murphy after they beat Duke. I was like, can you just play a normal game? And he's like, I hope so. And he really hasn't since. So, I mean, he doesn't have any control over it. Yeah, I mean, like, okay, so here's how I see it. And I think I said this on the podcast last week. I'm just going to say it again. There are five teams that are like competing for the four Ivy League tournament spots, in my opinion. I don't think Brown and Dartmouth are in contention. Three of them are incredibly slick, incredibly skilled, and not quite as athletic as the other two, who probably aren't quite as skilled or slick. So you've got Penn, Princeton, and on the slick and skilled side. And then you've got Cornell and Yale on the physical and athletic side. And Penn's defense is the outlier. Penn's defense is very athletic and physical. When those teams match up against each other, it creates interesting dynamics that are hard to predict, right? I was the least bit surprised that Cornell beat Yale because it's the two physical teams going against each other. One of them was at home. One of them had the benefit of the refs, all that other stuff. Cornell beats Yale. Like, it was, I you could see it coming a mile away. Like, I think Yale is going to beat Penn and Princeton because of the athletic advantage they have, similarly to the way in which their game against Harvard unfolded. I don't think that Cornell is, like, quite there in order to have as much of an advantage over Penn, Princeton, and Harvard as Yale does from a we're going to win this way standpoint. And so as a result, like, I mean, yeah, they jumped out to a lead, but they were on the road. Like, I don't know, man. I'm not going to say I saw it coming because I certainly didn't. But in retrospect, the fact that Penn won in that fashion against that team, not surprised. So very significant result, but at the same time, like, you know, just par for the course.
Well, and I love the games where it's like pretty much whatever biases you came in as.
It totally affirms them regardless. Yep. You can be like completely diametrically opposed.
Yeah. Just this game, you were right. Whatever you thought coming into this game, you were right. Even if you were a Cornell fan and you were going to say, we were going to blow them out of the water. You know, Penn stole one from us and Penn always does crazy stuff like this. And anything to add? Because I don't know how long the next topic I'm going to bring up is going to take. But any other thing that you want to add about Penn Cornell?
No, sir. I want to hear the next thing you don't know how long it's going to take is.
So this, we've reached a point in the season and no better weekend than the most Division I games played in the history of America, of the universe, of the Milky Way galaxy, of zoom out as however far you want. We're deep into the season and we've focused a lot on the important matchups. Who have we missed? Who deserves the shout out? You know, our Army beats UNC. We've talked about both of those. Navy beats Colgate. We talked to Navy last week. We talked about Colgate at the start of the season. St. Joe's, they lose their first three and they've rattled off six wins in a row. What are the storylines that you kind of want to highlight that sometimes get forgotten in the flow of, these are the important games? And we'll call this the shut up segment. Because a lot of people sometimes, well, not a lot of people, there's like three of them, but they're in my DMs and they're like, you got to talk about the MCLA and you got to talk about insert my favorite team. Let's shut up a couple people. What have we missed and who do you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I think it starts with St. John's. They played the first game on Saturday and they beat Marquette. This is a team that beat Penn State last year. You know, Marquette is a good team. They were like within the skin of their teeth of making the Big East tournament. St. John's was winless last season under Justin Turry in their first year. They started 0-5 this year. They have now won four of their last six games. The Johnnies deserve a little bit of shine, a little bit of love, a little bit of credit. And that is where it starts for me. Another one that caught my attention, Fairfield, 18. Drexel, 13. Fairfield started 0-3. They're 5-2 in their last seven games. This was a team that I think their offseason storylines was more about who they lost in the transfer portal, like Jack McKenna going to Ohio State. Yeah, Bryce Ford back, really good player, leading the Stags, and now they're all of a sudden in serious contention as it relates to the CAA tournament. A couple other kind of head scratching, eyebrow raising results. Bucknell, they're 3-7. They had lost four straight. Lafayette was a team that had turned the corner in the Patriot League. Bucknell 17, Lafayette 8. That is a very significant result on March 30th. I don't think it's going to factor necessarily into the way in which the Patriot League tournament comes to fruition, but it was one that I saw and I was like, huh. I want to make note of that. And then the last one that I'll mention before I turn the baton back over to you is Sacred Heart, 17, LIU, 16. LIU is a little bit of a darling. We have talked a lot about Quinnipiac. We've talked a lot about NJIT. LIU had won seven straight games after losing their season opener. They fell 17-6 to Sacred Heart. And John Basti's team is a group that hasn't gotten a ton of love over the course of, you know, his tenure, but their record under just in terms of the way that this season has unfolded, they have won five straight games. They've won seven of their last eight after losing their first three to open the season. And, you know, just again, like a really impressive showing out of what they've put together in terms of their positioning within the MAC down the stretch. They're 5-0. And, you know, if they can keep this thing rolling, they've got Quinnipiac up next. They might be in a position to, you know, make some noise in the MAC tournament down the stretch.
And I'm going to take this in a little bit different of a direction.
Are you going to talk about the MCLA?
Quite frankly, your Division I bias is disgusting, Terry. So I'm going to give a couple little MCLA shout-outs. So I follow Varsity Club Lacrosse, and probably, like, if you're not, I suggest you go and follow, like, 15 to 20 MCLA accounts. Tennessee, in particular, has been on a heater. Virginia Tech's pretty good because it's just the guy who's not playing tweeting from the sidelines. It's absolute mayhem. It's absolute chaos. And it fills up your feed with like, yeah, this is lacrosse related, but what are we doing here? This is fantastic. It's the game. It's how it should be played. So a couple MCLA shout outs, Virginia Tech, they're putting together a great year. Tennessee, Florida's also a great follow. Boise State cracked the top 25 rankings as well. So I got to get a little love to the Broncos. Shout out to all the MCLA boys scrapping it up. On the MCLA,
you got to go out there and get a practice in with them.
I actually have been meaning to, and I think I'm going to do it not this or next week, but mid-April. I'm going to go out and try and get a little tune-up. And honestly, just see how...
Thinking about a PLL comeback?
No.
Bill Tierney's going to find a roster spot for you on the Dogs?
If he offered me a roster spot, I'd say, Coach, like, come and pick me up because I ain't going. You're gonna have to get a forklift to get me off the couch. But I want to see how seriously they take it because I was on a road trip a long time ago when life wasn't great. I practiced with Iowa State, Tennessee, a couple other programs. The variety of, all right, guys, here's our practice plan, this and that, to, all right, guys, we have a case of beer. Let's all have a couple before we start practicing. It's just awesome lacrosse. And then on the MCLA Division II side, two programs that I know well, St. Thomas and Air Force. We work with them both on second slide stuff. They're number one and two. So shout out St. Thomas and shout out Air Force. Keep grinding, boys. Keep making us proud.
Do you think they're number one and two because of their affiliation with Second Slide, or do you
really
think that,
you know, so many other programs are dealing with the apparel industry and we are their North Star?
It's taking too much of their attention, too much of their bandwidth, for sure.
And then the final program I want to shout out, they were getting a decent amount of preseason hype and they've dropped three games this year. Delaware. I think Delaware is still sneaky. They're going to sneak their way into the tournament.
Are we talking about the varsity team or the MCLA team?
The varsity team, the Delaware Blue Hens.
The Ben DeLuca team.
The Ben DeLuca team. They lost to Penn by one and Michigan and Cuse, but I would argue that they're going to win out. Three good teams. They have really no, like, they just beat every team. They beat Hofstra by three, and that's their closest margin of victory. So I just want to watch out for the Blue Hens. I've always liked that program. I think if you're in that middle tier thinking about, should I go to Bucknell, Quinnipiac, whatever it is, Delaware is going to provide you a lot more fun. It's an election
first state.
Year. Yeah. First state, election year, current president's from Delaware. Take that for what you will. And I'll give a little love to the Blue Hens, and before we start talking politics or before my family overhears me saying anything, I think that might be a good note to log off so I can go defuse bombs in the back in the kitchen. So.
Nikio, we appreciate your time on the Tailgate Podcast. Unbelievable as always. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review, or don't. This probably wasn't the one that we want to get your review from, but that being said, if you picked up any tips on how to handle a roast, specifically if you thought that it was already pre-cooked and it turns out it wasn't, leave a review, tell a friend, and we will be back later in the week with more Inside the Cross podcasts, and of course, next Monday with more Tailgate. Nick, you're the best. Appreciate you.
Love you, Terry.
Love you, buddy.